In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If I had to nutshell today's show, it's citizens answering the call. Everyday people who got fed up with what was happening with our government and stepped forward to do something. You know, that sentiment of if you can do something, then you have a responsibility to do it, is in the lifeblood of Americans. In fact, it's in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence. When following a long train of abuses, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. But that's not always easy. And I have to say, Democrats tend to be more savvy about such things, on politics and the political machinations, using the rules and so forth. Remember, politics and government is their business. They are able to vote themselves billions of dollars from taxpayers that you pay for. In Oregon, every time you pay your electric bill, you're chipping into the Support Democrat Causes Fund, known as the Public Purpose Surcharge. It's not going to the public. It's the public paying for Democrat purposes. It doesn't go to Republican causes, only left-wing, we believe in global warming because it gets us money causes. That's who gets the money. A patriot's job is not to mindlessly obey the government. A patriot's job is to make sure that the government obeys the government, like following that pesky constitution. A patriot always stands by their country, not necessarily by the current government. In fact, many times it falls to patriots to replace the existing government and vote them the heck out. We've said it before, the fastest way to get real change is to get Republicans elected and then let them try to do what the Democrats have been doing. Whether it's spend billions of public money on Republican causes or call it a health emergency to seize power and grab endless amounts of power, just let the Republicans try to do that and then suddenly Democrats will say, "Now wait a second, you can't do that. It doesn't matter that we've been doing it. You can't." Fine, and get them to sign on the dotted line and we can all be happy moving forward. The solutions Oregon needs is not going to be found among the permanently elected class. As long as we keep electing the same kinds of politicians who got us into this mess, we're never getting out. Think about it. When a business is struggling, what do? They bring in someone from outside the business to develop solutions. Because the solutions can't be seen by the people inside the company. If they could see them, they'd fix them. But besides following the Constitution, elected officials need to follow the laws. Like following the laws about the Elliott Forest and the school trust funds. So on today's show, two people answering the call and stepping up because never-ending politicians won't back down. To talk more about the battleground that is the Elliott Forest, I'd like to welcome Dave Sullivan. Dave is joining us by phone. Dave, it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you. This is a fun topic to chat about just because what the state of Oregon is doing is so bizarre.
Oh, absolutely. I should mention also that Dr. Dave is an emeritus professor at College of Business at OSU, and he's filing a lawsuit to bring the Elliott back online. And so longtime listeners of iSpy Radio know about the school trust lands, that public lands were set aside to be harvested for lumber and to get the highest financial gain from these lands. The trees grow back and voila, and an ongoing source of funding for schools. And it worked well for decades. So am I missing anything so far in that basic concept of what the school trust lands are?
Yeah, it's a heritage for our children. And mm-hmm. and that was set up even before the U.S. Constitution was signed. Hmm. And land was the most valuable thing in our society back then. And the founding fathers of our country wanted to make sure that schools were taken care of. And so back in the 1700s, they started this program. And ever since then, different legislatures and politicians have tried to basically steal from our children for the political cause of the day. And now Oregon is on the front line of that.
Mm. And this is from your website, oastl.org, Oregon Advocates for School Trust Lands, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. And this is from your website there. It says, school trust lands were granted to states at the time of statehood for the sole purpose of generating revenue in perpetuity for public education. So how is it that Oregon and I think some other states have started to move away from this concept to basically take some of these state lands offline? Are we just so flush with cash right now that we just don't need these other sources of revenue?
Now, whenever you're a politician, you get elected based on saying you're going to do good things for people. And so Kate Brown, as an example, suggested that she wanted to help with climate change and sequestering carbon and making our planet better. If you were dealing with Montana, where you've got Republican type politicians, they're interested in grazing rights and making it good for farmers. And so in Montana, the Advocates for School Trust Lands, which is a national organization, is filing lawsuits trying to prevent the state legislature and the governor from giving away grazing rights to ranchers instead of having the school trust lands provide money to schools. And in Oregon, we have more of a Democratic leaning group, and they're interested in sequestering carbon. But either way, you're basically breaking a contract that was signed explicitly by the state when it received federal lands at statehood to be used in perpetuity for children. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a straightforward breach of trust. And there's really no one that has an incentive to file lawsuits and complain about it, because individual school children are in Oregon, every school child is losing about $70 per year annually because of this theft of the Elliott State Forest. But that's not enough money to cause any individual school, and school children don't know anything about courts anyway, right? So there's a very thin line of defense that is being held up by the national organization, Advocates for School Trust Land.
So recently, the Elliott Forest has essentially been removed from the school trust lands. We're no longer going to be harvesting the Elliott. Now we're going to study it. So can you thumbnail for our listeners why the Elliott is no longer an income producer for the state?
Well, opinions could vary about that. I think a little bit of history is going to be important to answer this question well. The Elliott State Forest itself was created in 1930 as a land swap because the parcels of land that were given to the state statehood were scattered all around the state. And so Francis Elliott, state forester, worked for about 10 years to get the feds to swap out all those scattered parcels for the Elliott State Forest. And then it was managed to produce value from primarily the 1950s through the 1990s, and schools got $700 million of value for that. And then people decided that, I think what I would call newspaper or urban environmentalists, that it's a bad move to harvest trees from the Elliott State Forest. So they got school buses and blocked roads and locked themselves into Oregon Department of Forestry offices and filed lawsuits. And over time, they made enough of a stink to where politicians decided it just wasn't fun to be fighting the environmentalists. And so they basically caved. And Kate Brown and the other two trustees on the state land board fired the Oregon Department of Forestry and the state forester as the managers and hired a forester in Bend, Oregon, which is a 4.5-hour drive away. And Ryan Singleton, who's that man, was told not to harvest anything off the forest, literally. So he's not harvesting mistletoe or chanterelle mushrooms or huckleberries. You know, if you file permits for that, he was routinely denying all of that. And so that happened about 2017. So for the last 4 or 5 years, not a single stick of wood has been harvested commercially from the Elliott State Forest.
That's absolutely astounding, especially when it's designed to be harvested. So let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Dave Sullivan talking about his lawsuit against the state to bring the Elliott Forest back online. Stay with us. And welcome back. We are talking today to Dr. Dave Sullivan. He's an emeritus professor at the College of Business at OSU, and he's filing a lawsuit to bring the Elliott back online. And Dr. Dave, we were talking during the break there about the misguided motivation and as to why they were taking the Elliott offline. You want to go ahead and continue with that?
I'll try. Now, Kate Brown, our governor, is also the trustee of this forest. And as a trustee, she's supposed to have undivided loyalty to the beneficiaries, which would be the schools. But as a practical matter, she's very concerned, and perhaps with cause, about climate change and all the carbon that's going into our atmosphere. And so one way of being able to remove carbon from the atmosphere is to grow trees. And so a very popular idea amongst environmentalists is we should stop cutting trees and grow forests and store carbon in the forest. And I believe that that's really the ultimate reason why she broke her legal requirement of undivided loyalty to the schools and stopped all harvesting on the Elliott State Forest. The problem with this is that forests are not a good long-term place to store carbon. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward. A year and a half ago, we had millions of acres mm-hmm. of Oregon forest burn up catastrophically. And it turns out that once a raging forest fire gets going, we have no way of stopping it. And the forests that burned were primarily national forests and state forests that hadn't been harvested. They were not the private forests. So the Elliott State Forest itself has this huge history of burning up. One of the reasons why the feds were happy to give it to us is that it had burned catastrophically and repeatedly in the 1800s. And once you have a forest fire rip through trees, then the first time it just burns off all the green and the trees die. But the next time it's worse.
Yes.
And that's because with dead trees, they dry out. And anybody that's built a campfire knows that dried wood burns much better than green wood. And so then you have
Thank goodness they're starting the study there on the Elliott Forest so that they can now truly understand that dry forests actually do burn more than the green ones do. And again, getting back to your point about carbon, if it's about carbon, if it's truly about global warming, then you would want to do even more forest management, not less. But so here's the thing. If they're taking the Elliott offline, how long before you think they start taking other forests completely offline? And do you think that's the eventual goal here?
Yeah, I actually do, because what they spend $1 million having the College of Forestry write up a research plan about how they would use the Elliott State Forest as a research forest. And there's no particular reason why they would use the Elliott Forest for that, because right next door is the Siuslaw National Forest that's being managed already as a sort of reserve, and it would be quite easy to use that. So we don't need more research forests. Oregon State University already has 10. All the 10 that they have are not as large. So the real issue is that if you store carbon in this manner, it is going to burn. It's like the earthquakes that happen in Oregon. They don't happen very often. They happen once every 300 to 600 years because things are locked up, but they are going to happen. You can't just talk your way out of it. And if you don't harvest anything on a forest, you get more and more carbon
right. And
a bigger and bigger likelihood that you're going to have a catastrophic fire. It will happen. It's not an if, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's what really bothers me about this whole thing is that they're setting up a firebomb.
Well, we have certainly known since caveman days that trees burn. What exactly do they think that they're going to learn new by studying this forest? And is it truly about studying forests or just studying how to make money by studying?
People feel good about having a beautiful forest to look at. And so when you cut down areas, you have clear cuts that look bad for a while. So I think that's part of the answer, is to just avoid having that happen. A lot of folks in the urban part of the world just don't believe that we should be cutting down ancient trees. And they're confused because the Elliott State Forest really doesn't have anything more than just a few acres
right.
of ancient trees because right. it was burned over. So I think that a lot of this is just sort of misguided hugging of puppies and kittens and folks that don't have. I mean, I'm living and talking to you now from 200 acres of timberland that I actively manage, and it's much more fireproof than the Elliott State Forest, which is overgrown, and I'm still harvesting in a sustainable manner. I'm just confused by the whole thing.
Well, I'm confused too, because if they were to look out across a field of growing corn, wouldn't you want to harvest that at some point rather than just letting it stand there and dry out and then become a fire hazard? I mean, shouldn't we be using these things? I mean, that's why we grow these things, is so that it can be used by mankind. And also we're taking care of those forests by thinning them, as you say, and routinely harvesting them. That's a healthier forest than just letting it sit there and burn and get infested by bugs and everything else when that happens.
Yeah, we have two kinds of forests in Oregon. And the private forests, I think, should be labeled as tree farms because people are managing them. They've got lots of trees. They're healthy. But when you cut down areas, you replant. And then you've got a bunch of federal areas that have mostly just been shut down because of concerns about spotted owls and whatnot. And those are more parks or reserves. And so really, I think part of the debate here is, should the Elliott Forest be converted from a tree farm, which it legally is supposed to be, which is supposed to produce revenue, and convert it into a park or a reserve? And if you read the million-dollar plan that Oregon State College of Forestry ended up writing, it's that plan is going to shut down. The forest itself grows about 80 million board feet per year, and they're going to be harvesting about 17 million under that plan. So basically, it's being converted into a park or a reserve.
Hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back. We want to talk about your lawsuit. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Dave Sullivan after this. And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Dave Sullivan. He's an emeritus professor at the College of Business at OSU, and he's filing a lawsuit to bring the Elliott back online. And so, Dr. Dave, in terms of just the overall nonsense of this, this is the thing that really jumps out at me, is that you would think that as a state, we like to get money, you know, into the coffers to pay for things like schools and roads and some of the other things that these state lands were originally set up for. But now, by taking the Elliott offline, we've gone from an income producer to something that we're going to be dumping money into. And I just don't see even a remote shred of common sense there.
Well, the economics are easy to sort of quantify, and they're at the heart, because I'm a business professor, they're at the heart of why I'm filing this lawsuit.
Hmm.
So when we purchased the Elliott State Forest, well, we didn't actually purchase it. It was a land swap, but, you know, it was... When we got the land swap back in 1930, the place had been burned over repeatedly, so it had really young trees. And Jerry Phillips, who was the long-term manager, estimates that at that point it had 600 million board feet of timber. And today, a board foot of timber is roughly worth a dollar when you get it to the mill. So at that point, it was worth roughly $600 million in terms of the value of the standing trees. And that would be part of that value would go to the loggers and hauling it to the mill, and part of it would be associated with the landowner. We've now not harvested, and we've grown up trees to where it has about 2.5 billion board feet of timber, or the total value of the trees on that place is about $2.5 billion. And about half of that should go to the landowner, and about half would go to the mills and the logging, all of the hundreds of jobs that have been shut down because they've stopped all harvesting. So, but the reason why I'm really concerned about this is they're talking about trying to buy it for around $226 million based on a whole variety of chicanery and trickery kinds of things. So they're basically doing what is called self-dealing. Self-dealing is when you sell something to yourself and you're the trustee and you rip off the beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries are the schools. So they're basically trying to buy the Elliott for this research forest while they're cheating the schools by paying pennies on the dollar. And it's just not only do I believe is illegal, but it's just immoral.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the state is just shirking a fiduciary responsibility, not to mention laws. We should be making millions of dollars instead of paying millions of dollars. Plus, they're selling it, as you say, for pennies on the dollar. It is just insane. So aside from the economics of things, we wanted to have you on because you're having this lawsuit going. What's the ultimate goal for your lawsuit?
Well, I want them to meet their responsibility to the schools. And so that should, because I was on the Corvallis school board for years and we never had enough money to be able to do the things that we thought we ought to do. And so taking a traditional historic source of money and basically flushing it down the toilet
right.
is just wrong. Now, admittedly, it's not a huge amount of the overall Oregon school budget. $70 per student per year is not going to completely transform things, but why in the world would you want to take $70 per student per year and put it into carbon sequestration as opposed to when it's legally supposed to go to the kids?
Yeah, exactly. So what's the status of that lawsuit? Last I knew, Polk County had denied you standing on that, but I know that you're in the process of appealing that. Where does that stand right now?
Yeah, you're correct. The Polk County ruled that I personally do not have the right to file this lawsuit. And that's being appealed, and I believe that I'll end up winning the appeal. But let's assume that I don't end up winning the appeal. I'm also on the national board of the group called Advocates for School Trust Lands. And Advocates for School Trust Lands can sue on behalf of its members. And of a fistful of Oregon school districts have signed up as members of Advocates for School Trust Lands. So if I get denied standing, then immediately the national group will file the same exact lawsuit and they'll get past the legal roadblock of standing. And so the substance of this lawsuit will eventually reach courts and the courts will decide. And I believe that they'll end up deciding that, what the heck, you can't rip off the schools. This was a contract signed when the state was founded.
So that actually brings me to my next question. Why aren't schools themselves suing? I mean, it's their money after all.
Oh, no. That's the Stockholm syndrome, and it's very understandable. If Kate Brown is both the person that manages this trust, and she's also the person that decides how much of the general fund will go towards education. And if 99 cents out of the dollars comes from the general education fund, and only one penny out of the dollar comes from the Elliott State Forest, and you say, gee, I'm a school district. I'm going to sue you about how you're illegally doing things with the Elliott State Forest, and I'll end up winning my one penny. Then she could just turn around and sort of smile at you and say, okay, what portion of the 99 cents do you think you're going to get next year? So you really need to have someone independent of the school system, like me, filing this lawsuit, because the Stockholm syndrome is where you're captured by someone else and you can't really negotiate anymore because they've got the gun pointed at your head.
Sure. Yeah, you're essentially blackmailing people into compliance. Well, Dave,
yeah.
We definitely want to stay in touch with you as your lawsuit winds its way through the courts, and we really wish you the best as this moves forward.
Hey, this has been fun. Thanks for talking with me.
Remember what I said in my opener about Democrats being savvy politically? And one strategy they use more than Republicans do is that if they are in a Democrat-safe district, meaning there are a lot of Democrats and the Democrat candidate is very likely to win, they fan out and support candidates in other districts. And that's one reason why it looks like there are so many of them, because they're spreading it out into other districts, like viruses, that aren't so Democrat-heavy, spreading paid staff into other districts to organize and get out the vote, and especially to get people in safe districts to donate and support via social media and more, support candidates in other districts that need help. So if you're listening right now in CD2 in Oregon, that's a very safe district for Republicans. Or maybe you're in a hopelessly lost district that, short of a miracle of a parting of the blue sea, no Republican is going to win. If either of those apply to you, put your monies and energy into other districts that could win and beat the Democrats at their own game, like in CDs 4, 5, and 6. Today we're talking with Dr. John DiPaola, who is running for U.S. Congress in City 5. That used to be from the mid-coast over into the mid-Willamette Valley, but thanks to Democrat gerrymandering, now it's the eastern portion of the valley reaching up into Bend and Deschutes County and also up into the outskirts of Portland, because that makes total sense if you're gaming the system. But now that the rules are set, let's win it. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell our audience, tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am not a politician and have never wanted to be a politician. I'm a citizen, like most folks. And I always took an interest in politics, but in 2020, I retired and had more time to investigate things and became very, very upset about the breakdown of the traditional systems and the American, what I call the American franchise. And the American franchise is each American citizen is entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and everyone gets one vote. And this is a social contract that has been preserved over the years by both parties, but it seems like in the past few years that the liberal wing of the Democratic Party has been focused on destroying this. And I don't want this safety net to go away, and I don't want my children and grandchildren to live in a world that is so different from the one I was privileged to live in.
Well, absolutely right. And I think what you're describing is what a lot of people are going through right now. They're busy with life, and then you get time to look around, and suddenly it's like, what the heck? When did this start? Like what happened over in Virginia with parents suddenly waking up to what their kids were actually being taught.
Yeah, you know, you always felt like that everyone was going to honor it, so you could just relax and go
right
about your life and
right
focus on family and your community, but that's not the case anymore, and so it's necessary for people to step up. And I'm grateful to see, as I travel around the state, that many, many citizens are stepping up to serve in some capacity or the other to restore American traditions and the security that we've mm-hmm all enjoyed over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a recently retired orthopedic surgeon, as you said, back in 2020. And I'm sure as a doctor, you never had to deal with any government overreach or regulations. So what was some of the worst government overreach that you had to personally deal with or that you saw in your profession?
Mine is an interesting story. When I went into practice, I quickly realized how much the government was increasingly getting involved in not only defining the types of conditions that I could treat, but what I'd be paid and regulations around mm-hmm privacy and other issues that made it more and more difficult to spend time with people and develop relationships with your patients. And gradually the regulations became so onerous and cost so much administratively that we had to modify how we were conducting ourselves as healthcare providers. And so we had less and less time to spend with patients, and the administrative costs kept going up. The ability to get paid fairly for the effort that you put into taking care of a patient was compromised, especially with Obamacare and managed care.
Mm-hmm.
All of those issues came into play early in my career. I fortunately come from a blue-collar background, and I've done blue-collar work all my life, and I relate very strongly to working people. So about 12 years into my career, I decided to focus only on workers' compensation cases, which involved a completely different kind of administration than a normal, what we would refer to as a commercial case. But the good thing about it is that the workers' compensation system always stayed pretty much the same. So you could create a business plan that integrated with that system. And if you're only dealing with one insurer instead of dozens and dozens of insurers who had different contracts, you always knew what the situation was, and it was much easier as a business person. But I didn't have anyone to show me that business plan. I had to develop it myself. And that was helpful. But then you know, the state taxes came into play, the cat tax and others, where, you know, my practice would spread across different county lines. So I was paying property taxes in three different counties
Wow.
every year. And my taxes were so complicated that it cost me thousands and thousands of dollars just to stay in compliance.
I don't doubt it. And in fact, the compliance issue is something I want to talk to you about, because you had retired in July 2020, I think before a lot of the COVID restrictions started taking full effect. But let's go ahead and take a break early. We'll talk about that coming up next with Dr. John DiPaolo. He is running for Congress in CD5. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. John DiPaolo. He is running for U.S. Congress in CD5. That's in the eastern side of the valley, up into Deschutes and Bend, and then up into Multnomah County as well, thanks to Democrat gerrymandering. And Dr. John, you were talking there about what it's like to have dealt with some of this government overreach as a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon. And you had retired in July of 2020. And am I right in remembering that that was before a lot of these really strict COVID restrictions started hitting, especially within the medical field?
Actually, it kind of came like a hammer, because all of a sudden we had to restrict the number of people that could be in our waiting rooms. We had to completely change all of our systems in the office. We had to put up shields between our staff and the patients. We could not have family members in the exam rooms. So it was very difficult, and it pushed down our productivity so dramatically and so suddenly that we immediately spun into a financial crisis as far as the running of the practice. And I did end up getting a PPP loan. So the COVID restrictions came into play in early 2020. So I had to deal with them through July. And I must say it was one of the things that made me grateful for deciding to retire at that time, was not having to deal with all of these issues. And the other thing is that many patients were frightened to come into the office. And so we had to develop a way of communicating with the patients over the phone. And also, I was a surgeon, so they suspended all surgeries immediately.
Wow.
And the main financial driver of a surgical practice is actually performing surgery. So you took away your main source of revenue suddenly, and then crippled your alternatives, which were seeing patients in the office. And we even had trouble initially getting paid for doing phone consultations, because the fee schedule was much, much lower for a phone consultation than it was for an in-person consultation. So there was just a period of time where you were eating lost revenue because you just didn't, they had not yet accommodated, they being the payers, had not yet accommodated to the new situation. So they didn't have a system in place to pay you. So they used the old system, which you did not get reimbursed. So it was like running a candy store and giving away all the candy and not and trying to keep the doors open.
Really? Well, there's a lot to unpack there. You mentioned essentially the fear porn that was being pushed by the government to just terrify people. To this day, I still see people in grocery stores just fully masked up. They've got shield on and masks. It's like, you know, we're out of this right now, and it's pretty clear that, you know, things are on the decline, and yet they're still terrified of contact with people. So talk to us a little bit about that, what that was like dealing with your patients, and did they start to finally wake up, or were they still in full panic mode?
No, that was still in full swing when I left, and like you, I'm amazed to go out and about and see somebody in the car by themselves with the windows closed and a mask on.
Yes.
It makes me feel compassion for those folks because, you know, Dr. Fauci, his job is to improve the public health. And he failed in
yes.
improving our public health dramatically. And I don't want to take time to go through that, but I do want to respond to your question about people being afraid right now. And the other day, I just was thinking, you know, what are they talking about? They've changed all the language. They they changed what it means to have a case of something. If you have a case of an illness, then you're getting sick. But they changed the definition of a case. And I went online and looked at the CDC website. And currently, the definition of a case is that you would have two or more of the following symptoms. And I'll list them quickly. But fevers, chills, shakes, muscle aches, headaches, sore throat, congestion, runny nose, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or fatigue. And those are all symptoms consistent with the seasonal flu or allergies or just getting a normal GI virus that people get all the time. And so if you had two of those symptoms, even if you don't have a positive test for COVID, you're considered a COVID case. So when you go into the different facilities and they ask you if you've had the symptoms, if you report yes, they report a case, even though you might just be having a seasonal allergy. So then I looked at the chances of you dying from COVID in Oregon. And Oregon has a population of 4.2 million people, and there have been about 7,000 deaths from COVID in Oregon. That means that you have a 0.2% chance of dying from COVID in Oregon, according to my quick math. And then I thought, well, what does it mean if you have a case? Well, there's 700,000 cases. That means there's a 17% chance that you would become a case, which is very loosely defined. And then recently, we found that the Johns Hopkins released a study that showed that all these lockdown issues did not produce any effect. In fact, 99.98% chance they were ineffective.
Yes.
And yet after that study came out, and while all these statistics were available to the health authority, they continued to push these mandates on us, and particularly on our children.
Yep.
So
I think right from the beginning, the entire COVID management was mismanaged. And you talked about how you were having to put off surgeries. Well, just think of the nonsense of that. On the one end, you're trying to allegedly protect people from COVID because they were saying at the time how likely you were to die, essentially, if you even got it. But then on the other side, you're having to put off these surgeries. So it's a total mismanagement there of just a person's normal health, because I'm pretty sure that if you need to do a surgery, putting it off orthopedically, you know, if it's an orthopedic surgery, putting that off isn't going to make it better.
No, no. And as far as the workers' compensation system, I've talked to the physician that took over my practice. He was conveying to me how many people, for instance, that had a shoulder injury that was easily operable that had to wait 6, 8, 9 months before they could even be evaluated again in person.
Wow.
And then they'd end up with a frozen shoulder and a lot of scar tissue and things that make the likelihood of a good result much less. Just because of the delay in being able to get treated.
Oh, it's just shocking. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with John DePaola. He is running for U.S. Congress in CD5. Stay with us. And we're back in our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Dr. John DePaola. He is running for U.S. Congress in CD5. That's the eastern side of the Willamette Valley and up into Deschutes County and Bend area, and then up into Multnomah County as well. And Dr. John, we were talking there about the mismanagement of the COVID pretty much from the get-go. So if you got elected to Congress, what laws would you trying to put forward in order to get a better handle on the CDC, especially robbing them maybe of some of this ultimate power that they've given to themselves?
Well, I think, first of all, the public health structure, the bureaucratic structure, needs to be dismantled and reconfigured. I don't think that people should serve in a public health capacity if they have conflicts of interest with medical industry. Yes. And it's not just the pharmaceutical industry. I have seen it involved in other parts of the medical industrial complex where new devices or a new challenge arises and a treatment or a device is implemented with catastrophic results. So that's number one. And there are many, many researchers and scientists who don't have conflicts of interest who would do a very good job. Too much power has been concentrated there. The other aspect is executives in state and federal government have the ability to declare states of emergency. And these states of emergency seem to be able to continue indefinitely until that person decides to rescind the emergency declaration.
Yes.
I think that if an emergency is declared either federally, well, specifically federally for my office, that there should be a six-month review by Congress, and there should be a minimum amount of support or a designated amount of support, like a two-thirds or a one-half vote of the Congress to approve an ongoing declared emergency. Yeah. Because I don't think we've had in the very beginning, perhaps there was concern that this could be an emergency, but within a few months, it was pretty clear it was not an emergency,
right,
that we could release all these restrictions and deal with it in a routine manner.
Right. And also deal with it locally. They really robbed the local areas of really any of their power to deal with things because it was all top down. And as you said, there was too much power concentrated there. It was too much power in too few hands. And it also came down to believe our science or else. We certainly saw that with a lot of doctors some of whom had their licenses actually removed because they weren't believing the science. I do want to move on. We've only got a few more minutes here with you. I'm just going to look. This is from your website. You've got some of the issues that you are dealing with is COVID-19, education, environment, forest management, homelessness, immigration, public safety, small business, and veterans. And I want to talk to you a little about education because in talking with you yesterday, just to get a feel for the show, education, I know, is a big issue for you. So why don't you talk to our audience a little bit about what you've been dealing with?
Well, I've been hearing a lot from parents and parents groups about the indoctrination of our children. And the thing that is so shocking is that this has been going on for some time. The playing field has been set as far back as 2015 when the Oregon Education Administration passed a policy that 15-year-olds can undergo medical treatment without having to get parental consent. And that includes changing their sexual.
Yeah,
and so they can be counseled or they can receive medications or they can even undergo surgery without the consent of their parents for an agenda which the parents may not be fully aware of and for which I don't believe the schools should be focused on because it doesn't really reflect any concerns that the parents have, nor I see there's a huge enough problem to put that much energy into sex orientation.
Sure. Plus, that has been a big frustration for us here on the Aspire Radio Show, and as former parents ourselves, parents of former high school students, is that constant interference by the parent, by the schools, inserting themselves between the parents and the kids. That's very frustrating. And you had actually sent us something that we're going to put up on iSpyRadio.com that your wife had found. And it's a spring workshop series. Among the topics is the case for porn literacy. And this is extremely frustrating. I mean, you have adults pushing adult issues on kids. Let the kids be kids. And then when they're adults, they can do this kinds of on these kinds of things. But this is not stuff that schools should be focusing on. Moving on, though, we'll have to have you back maybe to talk a little bit more about education. But the other thing that you're focused on is small business. And so what as a U.S. congressman would you be doing to help bring back businesses into Oregon, because right now we've had some of them fleeing. Intel just built a new plant, not in Oregon, but they built it in Ohio. So what would you do to help bring back businesses to Oregon?
Well, I think the federal tax structure could be revised to reduce pressure on small businesses to pay overwhelming amounts of taxes. I think also getting the economy running is really, really critical. The current administration has done everything it can to destroy our economy, in my opinion. They are undermining our national energy security, which undermines the ability of businesses to obtain products. The supply chains have been completely disrupted. And I think that, you know, for an entrepreneur to start a business against that kind of a headwind is just very, very difficult.
Absolutely.
And most new wealth in our country comes from entrepreneurs starting new businesses.
Yes. And
most jobs
and that means you're going to you really need, as the government, to get out of their way, not impose new restrictions. John, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time. We'll give you your website here in a second, but best of luck moving forward.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Get your pencil ready. Dr. John's website is dipaolaforcongress.com. That's DiPaola for F-O-R, not the number, congress.com. DiPaolaforcongress.com. One more time, DiPaola for congress.com. Or make it easy on yourself and head to iSpyRadio.com and we'll have it on today's show page down in the links and further information section. While you're there, check out what John sent us, what his wife had found. I think it was from one of his grandkids' schools. A free spring workshop series called My Future, My Choice, including one workshop called The Case for Porn Literacy. Well, isn't that marvelous what they want to teach your kids? For some teachers, you know, you get some level of Christianity, the golden rule, belief in God. How much better would society be if you could teach kids about Judeo-Christian values with the same level of explicitness and openness as they do about sex? Instead, if teachers tried to do that, they'd probably be fired. That is what your kids are facing, and we need to stop it. Remember, let's steal the Democrats' tactics and take these seats out from under them. So if you're in a safe district where the Republican is going to win anyway, or in a district with Democrats running wild, put your energy and support into the candidates in these competitive districts. At the congressional level, that's 4, 5, and 6. They need your support to help them win. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.